The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is comedian, actor, and writer, and part of the mega successful comedy troupe, Auntie Donna, Broden Kelly. Welcome to FOFOP.
Finally, is all I can say. I've been waiting years and years to be asked on here, and it's an absolute pleasure to join. What would you call this universe? The Tofopiverse
is generally how listeners refer to it as, the Tofopiverse. Yes, you are now, you've done a philosophy though, right? So you're officially part of the canon. You're canon in the TPU, Tofop Podcast Universe, TPU.
Yeah, TPU. Yeah, sounds like it's not cinematic STD. Yet, is it? Yeah.
Not yet.
That would be fantastic. I would, you guys are set up for that.
Yeah. We like to reboot movies. We have a million great ideas on Tofop, Broden, that we never follow through. I think we'd be more successful if we had any kind of like follow through on our million great ideas. Do you ever see that movie Night Shift with Michael Keaton, where he plays Billy Blazejowski?
No.
And he's an ideas man. That's his whole thing. I'm an ideas man.
Yes.
And that's like the thing.
Yes, okay.
And that's us. We're ideas men, but we have no follow through. We need more skilled people behind the scenes. And we have skilled people behind the scenes, don't get me wrong. But we need more skilled people to get us really successful.
Well, you just need to become powerful enough that you're right. You just task people with taking your crappy little idea you had and moving along with it. Like, I heard this from a person. But the production company that makes The Voice, apparently they were in an executive room, and one of the executives at whoever makes it, whether, I don't know, it's Shine, whoever makes it, was one of the CEOs or executives was just sitting in his swivel chair and went, there should be a show based around a swivel chair, do a swivel chair show. And that's how The Voice was made, reportedly. So you just need to become powerful enough that some poor 25-year-old is tasked with taking some dumb idea and taking it to fruition.
Well, isn't that that was what they always said about the Beatles, was that George Martin had a rule. It's like, always, if the Beatles are together in a room, always be recording. ABR. Mm. That's what George Martin used to say to them, because you never know. And I just finished, have you seen Get Back on Disney Plus?
No, but I've heard it's 9 hours long. Is that right? How long is it?
About that. Yeah, about 8.5 hours.
So they truly were always recording.
Yeah. And it's incredible, because you do actually get to sort of see that process of why they would always be recording, because there's two things. One is, like, sure, they're just human like the rest of us. To see them kind of not know how to put a song together and reach dead ends and stuff is so, like, heartening. But also, like, they fuck around. So much of their creative process is just jamming to other people's songs, or making up silly songs, or, playing the chords of a song which would eventually become Let It Be, but putting in, like, stupid lyrics. And it's like, oh, right. I wonder how much of... Like, I guess they're the Beatles, and this is at the end of their career, so everyone's going to give them whatever creative freedom they want. But I imagine when they were first in the studio, when George Martin first sat down with them and they start playing a bunch of, like, dirty limericks, that he's like, hey, dudes, you're on the clock. Like, but you realize that's their process, because, they have such kind of – I imagine it's the same with you guys as well. It's such, like, specific sort of skill sets, and there's a specific chemistry. You sort of got to allow people to kind of, like, work in their own way, and then hopefully that can coalesce.
The first time we decided we were a comedy group and enrolled for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival before any of us had really written comedy before, we kind of just did it on, we have to do this because acting's not working, and we don't have jobs and we've got to figure out a way to make something of our lives. So I remember we booked it, we named the show, we did funny little blurbs, and then we booked a library room in Carlton in Melbourne, 15 bucks, 3 hours, best deal in town, right next to a La Porchetta. And walked in. I remember we came in and we like did an actor warm up, like, and then we just went, right. and then realized none of us could write comedy. And then like the next 3 months, like in between our part-time jobs, was just going about figuring out how to be a creative. Mm. And I'm still obviously figuring that out, and to, you know, different levels of, you know, success. But there was one video that I have that was made by John Cleese, that was a friend of mine, showed me on YouTube. And it's like my go-to for how to be a creative person. And he says controversial shit now. Yeah. He's an old uncle in his 90s or whatever now. But that one video he made, he approaches like creativity from the scientific perspective. And a lot of it is about like the different parts of your brain that you engage to be creative. So it makes sense that like when you are fucking around, that's actually when your brain's in the right position to be creative.
Yeah. I did this a few acting classes with this guy, Les Chantry, in Sydney. They're not acting classes, they're more audition classes. And he sort of approached it from a similar point of view, which is, I'm not really an acting teacher, I'm more interested in the neuroscience of what makes people stand out. He kind of had this obsession with,
really?
What do people mean when they talk about charisma? Like when you hear about someone booking a job because they walked in the room. And so he was living in the States, so he interviewed a bunch of casting agents in Australia and in LA, and tried to sort of get an idea of what is it? What is star power? What is charisma? And he broke it down to this kind of like, I guess, neuroscientific level, which is, it's not really about being the best actor. Auditioning is not acting. Auditioning is like trying to get a job. It's really about being memorable, and it's really about presenting someone with something that they're not expecting. And the very first class we did, he gave us just like a short scene to audition on the spot. So we had like 5-10 minutes to go off and learn this scene, and then we had to do this audition. And then when we all came back to the class and we watched the tapes, he brought up all the thumbnails of everyone's tape. And it was a bunch of people on blue backgrounds all staring like deer in the headlights straight ahead. And he said, now, imagine you're a casting agent and you've just had like, you're going through 200 submissions and you open the thumbnails and it's just like 200 faces all the same. But then there's one guy who's, you know, backs to camera, or there's someone who's kind of doing something different. They're entering the scene in a different way, or maybe the frame's empty. And he said, it's sort of a microcosm of what you want to do with the entire performance, is that no one's looking, it's not a question of comprehension. No one wants to know how well you know the lines. They want to know what you bring that is different to this. And I mean, it sort of dovetails back to comedy, because he was saying that what they're finding now is, rather than going to drama schools, a lot of casting agents are going to comedy festivals, because that's where you're finding original voices. That's where, even if it's like a new comic or someone who's just sort of finding out what their act is, what they're getting up there is presenting a version of themselves that is unique. Like it's a completely different skill set. Like, you know, acting is almost about sort of disappearing into a role or becoming someone else, or, you know, there's so much artifice to it. Whereas comedy is more about getting up and like being really vulnerable. You know, I only did like a handful of stand-up shows when, you know, Michael Chamberlain and Charlie Pickering and I, we all were working together, and we had our own troupe for a short time. I think we did one comedy festival show.
Yeah. I want to see some footage.
No, please no. Please no. But it was funny, because I was obviously the one who was more interested in the acting side of things, where they were kind of more interested in the comedy. So I felt like the George Harrison in that relationship, because we did actually end up shooting a pilot. And I remember submitting quite a few sketches that were often rejected. Like it was predominantly, I think I got one or two in, predominantly written by Charlie and Michael in the end. But it was really interesting, because, you know, those guys, when they went into stand-up and I would go and watch them, I was like, I can't fucking do this. Like, this is terrifying. And I remember I did a couple of gigs. The first one is always great, because I had friends and, you know, family in the audience. But then I entered myself into raw comedy when I moved to Sydney. And I do not remember anything about that gig, because I was terrified. I just remember I got up there and I was like, how can I get through this as quickly as possible? I didn't try and kind of finesse the jokes. I didn't try and wait for laughter. I was just like, I'd written some stuff down. I'm just going to say it as quickly as I can and get on stage. It was just terrifying.
It reminds me of the first time I got an ad, because I went to drama school much like you, but then also like the only reason I moved to comedy was purely out of, like, as I said before, like no one wanted to come see Harold Pinter's The Dumb Waiter performed in a 30-seater with me and a friend for $45. no one wanted to see that. And then when I did Comedy Festival, everyone wanted to come see it. You know, A, might be funny, and B, I might fall apart on stage and you get to see me, you know, have an existential crisis. But what was really the first time I got an ad was after doing comedy for like 2 years, and it was just the freedom for me to go. Well, like usually when you go into an audition, if you're just an actor, in my experience, and the job is, I remember the brief was, you're going on a bike, you're going on a dirt bike trip with your mates,
yeah,
and you got your racking up your dirt bikes, and then someone shows up with their mountain bike, and you're like so upset with him because he's ruined the boy's weekend. And if you're an actor, you go in and you go, you perform, like you show all the ways that you're upset, and yes, you, and part of that performance is also, please give me the $5,000. And I remember I walked in and I just went, well, comedically the funniest thing to do is nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's, you're not giving a lot here. You're giving nothing. You're literally just staring. And then I got the gig by doing nothing. And that was the start of my career of doing just nothing and deadpan. But it's the, it is, you talk about charisma and confidence, or it's like the ability to stand there and go, this is enough, or what I'm doing is enough and I don't need to do more. And it's been interesting for me lately because I've been doing just comedy now for like a decade and do a little bit of acting here and there. But in recent times I've moved back to TV and acting for the first time properly for a very long time. And I've been hanging around actors all day and people who are purely actors, and actors versus comedians, you know, which is a core to the Tofopiverse.
Yeah.
Is,
that's what we should change the name of the show to, Actor versus Comedian.
Well, that's your end game, isn't it? That's like the big ending of the series.
Yeah, that's right.
Act comedy off. and like, no, the differences between the two worlds is like stark and interesting and very, and like, you know, it's been very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Like, I remember, because I always had mates in comedy and I'd sort of like dovetailed into acting. And so I was hanging around a lot of actors, and like, this is, I'm talking like 20 years ago, there was such a dismissive attitude from actors towards comedians, as if like, I don't know, it wasn't, I guess it's like, obviously it's not serious, but it was like, they're clowns, you know, they're not, you know, whereas I'm wanting to do Pinter or whatever it is. But I reckon that has flipped on its head entirely now, especially with the advent of things like YouTube and Instagram and stuff, where if you just, you know, are putting funny content out there, then eventually someone's going to come find you and want to work with you. Advertisers especially, like, no one's, I mean, I never went to drama school, so I can't really speak to that, but you know, why don't you go now?
Why don't you just enroll?
Just be like Rodney Dangerfield and back to school. Or Billy Madison.
Just be Rodney Dangerfield, though. Put like a Hawaiian shirt on and walk around with a pina colada.
Yeah. I'll do my own special effects makeup, just like really shoddy latex and a wig that doesn't fit.
Yeah,
but there was that, it was that attitude. And I think that has changed completely. And there's also, I think if you can do comedy, drama's a piece of cake. Because I think drama, like, that's all, I sort of started off, I guess, in comedy, or at least working with comedians and writing sketches and stuff, and then sort of moved into drama. But I think that, like, there is so much more nuance and skill to getting someone to laugh, whereas playing melodrama or playing drama, they're really, it's like really broad brushstrokes. Like, there isn't a lot that you don't, well, I just find that you don't really have to play the notes in between too much, because it's sort of simpler, where, like, it's hard because, you know, comedy, you don't want to play funny, because that never comes across as funny. Like, did you read about that Jeremy Strong interview he did in the New York Times? Jeremy Strong, who plays Kendall on Succession. Do you watch Succession?
Right, yeah. No, yeah, okay. I love Succession.
Oh, you do?
So
there's been this article, this interview, feature interview with Jeremy Strong came out last week, and it sort of like set the internet ablaze, because the tone of the author of the article is, it's not mocking, but it is kind of like, Jeremy Strong is not a method actor, but he takes his role very seriously. And, you know, he does certain things, like, you know, he stays separate from the rest of the cast, and, you know, he does a lot of research, and, you know, he's a serious actor. Mm. And so the tone of the article is like, hey, he's a bit of a weirdo. And so all these celebrities have leapt to his defense, like Jessica Chastain wrote an open letter and Anne Hathaway, and it's like Jeremy Strong is one of the. And then the rest of the internet's like, hey, chill out, celebrities. Like, no one's like bagging Jeremy Strong. It's just saying he's a bit of a weirdo. That's cool. Like, we want our artists to be weirdos. And there's one bit in the interview where they're interviewing all his castmates who are all sort of very diplomatically saying, yeah, Jeremy, you know, he's a weird cat and he sort of, he operates the way he wants to operate. And Kieran Culkin, who plays Roman, says, at one point he came up to me and he was a bit stressed out because he was saying, oh, I'm worried that everyone thinks that Succession's going to be a comedy. And Kieran Culkin's like, it is a comedy. But that's why Adam McKay cast Jeremy Strong, is that he plays it straight. Like, they didn't – it's the same with what's his name, Will Arnett in Arrested Development. Apparently when he went in for Job, he was playing the jokes. And they were like, no, just play it like with like honest intention. Like, you legitimately think you're this great magician. And it becomes so much funnier.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's you are one cog. And it's funny as well, because with my group, Auntie Donna, when we are shooting something, we laugh like there's no laughing. Like, there's moments where we like properly lose it. But when we're trying to play and try and find funny moments, no laughing.
Yeah, right.
And doing it, going back to a TV show now and playing a funny part in a show that goes more serious at points. Actors laughing left, right, and center. Like, they're like, it's this funny world where, like, oh, I think also you see it with crew members and things on shows where, like, if they've just been on a very serious film or TV show and then they come back to doing comedy, they're like, this is so, what? This is so nice and happy.
Yeah.
But all, like, for everyone around, you're like, but for actors, it's the most, like, doing comedy, it's the most serious thing often, a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you often hear the stories about like Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight, and it's like, well, to get into the mind of the Joker, you know, he had to disappear into a hotel room and, you know, enter the dark space. And did that contribute to his death? And it's like, hang on, fucking hell. Like, I mean, it's a job. It's still a job.
It's a good story.
Yeah. And everyone that you speak to, it's not like I have Christopher Nolan on speed dial, but every interview I've seen with Christopher Nolan or Aaron Eckhart are like, no, he was... like in between takes, he was joking and laughing. He wasn't doing like the Joker voice the whole time. Yeah. And then you fast forward to Jared Leto and he's sending people condoms and dead rats. It's like, Jesus fucking Christ. Like, on one hand, I kind of like, I do admire the commitment that an artist like Daniel Day-Lewis has to, well, Abraham Lincoln had a really high-pitched voice and never saw a mobile phone. So for the next year, you know, I'm speaking this voice.
Yeah.
I do admire that. But there is part of me which is like, oh, yeah, come on, dude. Like, we just want a break for lunch.
Well, it's like anything else, isn't it? Like, a lot of people say they don't like that thing. Like, I don't like jazz or I don't like improv comedy. But if you see someone at the absolute top of whatever field they're in do it well, you'll go, oh, well, I like that. I like that. Like, often people say, I don't like improv comedy. Improv comedy is the lowest form of comedy. And I don't come from that world. But I have seen, when you see someone, it's such a hard art form to get right.
Mm.
But if you get it right, it's possibly as funny gets. And it's the same with, you know, the method. Like, Daniel Day-Lewis doing method is different to Jared Leto doing method acting. I think it's the same. Like, I would say I would never watch an NRL game, but there have been some NRL games that I thought were okay, you know? At the top of any world, you know, any field, the best is enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, it is that thing too, isn't it? Where once someone's established as being a genius, you'll accommodate pretty much any kind of behavior. But it's having the courage. Like, I always think about that. You know, I've heard stories of, you know, actors, you know, going into auditions and arguing with the director and, you know, like storming out and slamming doors and like threatening and stuff. And they'll get the part because the director's like, oh, wow. You know, like the cut of his moxie. And I'm always like, if I tried that shit, like, I remember I worked on something like, this is way, 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 like in the late 90s, I was working as a director's assistant for a theater company. And there was this Australian actor who I won't name, but he was persistently trying to get an audition, but they didn't want to see him. They didn't think he was right for the role, but he kept calling and calling and calling. There's all these answering machine messages. And then they finally said, okay, you can come in and audition. So we set up a special time for him, like outside of when we were running the other auditions. And we were sitting there waiting, waiting. Half an hour goes by, 40 minutes goes by, an hour goes by. This fucking guy's been calling for 2 weeks and then is like late to this audition that we've set up. Finally, we hear this like car comes screeching up and he jumps out and he's all like hair's all messy, sunglasses. And he comes in with a six pack and he walks up to like the table that the producer and the director are sitting behind. He's like, oh, sorry, guys, I had a massive night last night. Here's a six pack, you know, on me, and sits down. And then does this audition, which was like a period piece, but makes no attempt to kind of adopt the, you know, the voice or the language of the time. And it's just like, you know, Susie, I feel like, you know, you and I could be friends or something like that. And then he leaves and I'm sitting there just shaking my head going, what a fucking idiot. But I turn to the director and producer. They're like, wow. Like, wasn't he like that? He's so dangerous and the energy he brought into the room. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, it's all about how charming you are, isn't it? If I could jump to another theater story, when I was 16, all I wanted to do was be in the theater. Mm-hmm. All I wanted to, like, I wanted to be at Melbourne Theater Company and do Shakespeare. And my musical director at high school got employed by Melbourne Theater Company in some sort of administrative role. So I'm sitting there at the year 11 formal, I get a phone call and it's my old teacher. And she says, can you come and be in a photo shoot for the program for the 2006 MTC photo like program for one of the shows? And I'm like,
huge.
Oh my fucking God. Yes. And I rang my mom like, Mom, I need you to bring me, you know, because I was staying at a friend's, I need you to bring me like school uniform for this photo shoot. There was a show called History Boys that was being put on. And I went down there the next morning and the artistic director was there, a lot of turtleneck scarves, a lot of, you know, and they're like, Broden, you're gonna sit on this bike and look and poke your head out. And I was like, this is like, maybe they're going to, you know, put me in this photo and I'm going to be in the program and I might not be in it, but it's a good, you know, foot into the door to being a great theater actor. And maybe they'll give me an audition. I'm 16, you know. Anyway, I get there and like poke your head out, Broden. I do this whole photo shoot. And then for like 6 months as a 16-year-old, I am the most egotistical little prick to every actor friend. I'm like, oh, I'm in the program and it was great working with the artistic director and, you know. Really fun shoot, really fun, you know. I'm like, and when the program comes out, you'll see, and we should all go see the show, you know. I might audition for it. And then, like, the program, and I'm at like, with my drama class on an excursion, and the program has come out, and there's a big pile of them in the foyer of this show. And someone goes, Broden, the program's here. I'm like, oh, great. I go pick it up, I open it up, the photo's there, the man on the front of the bike's there. And then it's me with Matthew Newton's head superimposed.
Oh my God.
On my head. History Boys.
Wow.
Coming August 2006. And I was, and there's that point that my theater career ended.
That's amazing. Oh man. I love theater stories, like especially amateur theater stories. I like Waiting for Guffman is one of my all-time favorite films. Like
how good is it?
Because I was part of many an amateur theater troupe, but I love stories of like you know, an amateur theater troupe taking on an ambitious project like a Strindberg or something like that. We did one when I was in first year uni, and I can't remember what the scene was or what even the play was. I think it was like scenes from it, wasn't necessarily the entire play. But it was me and this other actor. I was playing like a military general or something like that. And I was being confronted by someone who knew, you know, my dark secret, which was that I had fabricated my entire, you know, my being a war hero and stuff. And so the key moment of the scene is we're having this argument at the table. And then he reaches into his pocket and produces the document and slams them down on the table. And that's at that moment, I'm, you know, brought to my knees and I'm forced to admit that I'm a fraud. And so we're doing the scene and it's building tension. And I'm like, how dare you? And he reaches into his pocket and I see from the look in his eyes, he forgot to pack the prop and he's padding around trying to find it. And then he just goes, all right. And he looks and he goes, well, I don't have the proof, but you know it's true. And I have to go, well, yes, you're right. I guess you've talked me around.
You're really on board all of a sudden. make a persuasive argument.
I did another show where the directors, it was set, it's called Balm and Gilead, which is this sprawling like 3-hour play, like 25 characters or something. And they wanted it to have like a fairly dangerous kind of feel. So they cast a lot of street casting. They just found people. And
oh, yeah.
They cast this one dude to play like a heavy who I think they found at drinking at a bar in Newtown. And like this dude, I think, was a genuine, had genuine ties to the underworld or something. Just this big, scary dude.
Gritty. He's gritty, mate. That's what he is.
Yeah. I think like he was a felon is probably a more accurate description.
A gritty felon.
But his big moment was he's meant to come in at the end of the play and stab, you know, the lead actor and then and exit, has one or two lines. And he forgot to take his rubber knife onto stage. So he grabbed a real fucking knife from one of the tables because we had this like bar restaurant set. So he just grabbed the butter knife and just jabbed this guy, like this actor in the chest. The actor comes off stage and he's like, ah, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Then we open his shirt and he'd split his chest open, like cracked down to the
wrist.
This is like a co-op, by the way. I think we made like $40 each by the time the show finished.
Well, you didn't walk
up away.
That's $40 more than I think I've ever earned from theatre, so that's good.
What is your – I saw – so you guys have a Twitter account, and I'm never quite certain. Do you all operate the Twitter account or is it just –
That's the trick. That's the trick of a Twitter account that six people can log into. No paper trail, is there?
Yeah,
I
that's
can say
right.
whatever I want, and I can blame Zach or Mark or one of the other boys. That's – but no, usually it's me or Zach who does a lot of it, but I want you to cite the tweet and I'll – if
well,
it's not
it
me,
was,
I'll try and guess.
Someone went on a tweet flurry about a month ago about the new Batman trailer, about the Riddler having time to put a question mark in the coffee. And it was one of the funniest kind of tweet storms I've seen because it was so many tweets about something that I hadn't really put much thought into. Who was that?
Well, thankfully that was me. I was up in Cairns in a house by myself. I had a mental breakdown about the, cause the new trailer for the Batman, I don't know if I think it looks awesome. Mm. I think I'm really excited to see this movie. I'm like, when's it like March next year it comes out? I'm that excited for it.
Once you get to my age, you'll realize that these Batman trailers come out every 5 or 6 years.
Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. Do you know Michael Keaton owns a ranch?
Yes. Yes. I watched a 60 Minutes interview with him
only
a few days ago. Yeah.
He bought it. We must have similar YouTube algorithms.
Yeah. Oh, did you watch the same interview?
I did, yeah. He never talks about how much money he has, but that guy must just have highest grossing film in 1989 at a different time.
Yeah. Like, I mean, 400 million back in 89 would be what? Like close to $1 billion now, you would guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's funny because they did frame that interview. It was interesting, wasn't it? Where they're like, he made so much money from Batman, he could afford to pick and choose the next 15 years. And I'm like, I'm a huge Michael Keaton fan. In fact, my wife and I, one of the first things we bonded over, she was living in Melbourne, I was living in Sydney, and we'd spend a lot of time on the phone, is we'd talk about Michael Keaton. Like, it was so weird. Like, she one night, she's like, I have to go. Desperate Measures is on TV, and I love Michael Keaton. And I'm like, I love Michael Keaton. And so, like, he's been...
We should make a podcast about 80s Keaton, pre-Batman. So, yeah. You know, what's the one you said before?
Night Shift. That was the one that broke him in.
Because when I was young, my nana used to just always play for me this movie called The Dream Team. Do you remember The Dream Team?
Yeah, yeah, with Peter Boyle and it's kind of like One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, but
Christopher
Lloyd. That's right. Yeah, I'm a huge Michael Keaton fan. Mr. Mum, Gung Ho, The Squeeze. I've seen them all, mate. I've even seen his serious dramatic work.
Is Mullet Keaton, I guess, is the...
Yeah, it's interesting what he did with his hair. He kind of like obviously started losing it around sort of Batman, you'd say. And I don't know if he got plugs or whatever, but he's managed to just hang on to that just a little. He hasn't gone the full shaved like you. He's just gone just a little hint of hair.
Would you take, if you could only take one, would you take 80s Keaton or Twilight Keaton? So your Spotlights, your your 9/11 one that he just did.
I love the film that made me like really fall in love with Michael Keaton was Beetlejuice. I think that role it's so watchable, and he makes something pretty much out of nothing, or maybe not out of nothing because you have that amazing production design. But I bet you on the page that character was not nearly what he made it into. And I've read interviews with him where the idea behind the character is he wanted to make him like a washed up rock star who goes to like shopping centers and hits on mothers and all that kind of stuff. And when you sort of understand all that, but it's just, I remember seeing that I went and saw Beetlejuice at the cinema and it just sort of blew my mind because I'm like, is this horror? is this comedy? Yeah. I don't quite understand what I'm watching.
Yeah.
But then obviously...
Is that peak Burton? Is Beetlejuice peak Burton or Batman peak
Burton? I reckon Edward Scissorhands round probably mid-90s. I love Ed Wood. I think Ed Wood's probably Burton's favourite film. I can't watch a Tim Burton film these days because it's sort of like a parody of himself. Yeah. But I think it's a good question about Keaton because I think maybe from sort of Multiplicity onwards, it was a very barren times for old Michael. Like, I'd love to believe that he was just on his ranch in Utah or whatever it is, just fishing and stuff like that. But I get the feeling you're not doing Herbie the Love Bug and, you know, a bunch of the other First Daughter with Katie Holmes, you know, if you're getting the big offers. And I actually, when I was in LA, I was having a meeting with an agency who managed him. He used to be with one of the other big ones, and now it's with this other big one. And it was just after Birdman came out, and he was riding high and winning awards and stuff. And I was saying, oh, you've got Michael Keaton. I said, I love Michael Keaton. And like, yeah, Michael's great. And they say, but he has a long memory. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, oh, well, you know, he wasn't getting offers for a long time. And he remembers every single person
who
didn't answer his call and now was sort of like just kept that away. It's like, oh, no, I don't want to know that about Michael Keaton. I don't want to know that
Michael Keaton's got a list. He's got a list.
Because he's one of those guys too where I do love him as an actor, but when I've watched him on talk shows and stuff, I'm like, I think I'm just gonna compartmentalize my affection for you as a performer. It doesn't necessarily have to be, we have to be mates or anything like that. I'm not going to be obsessed about it.
Absolutely not. He's in this period now where you can sit and hang with him in most of his movies. And I do really enjoy that. But back to I also want to talk about Beetlejuice.
Mm.
I've said it a few times, but I spent 3 months in Queensland and I went to Movie World. I only got to get to Movie World twice, which is I think it's the best place in Australia.
Wow. I've never been.
Mate, you will do yourself a favor. Bring your kid down to kid or kids?
Kid.
Kid, bring your kid down to Movie World. It's the funniest place in the world because I think it's kind of shifting away from it now, but like it's just movie IP world. So like Austin Powers, you can get a photo with Austin Powers as well as Batman. They can be walking down the same street and Beetlejuice. And it's literally feels like 1994. And my dream when I was 12 was to be go to NIDA so that I could walk into a job at Movie World and be Batman there. That was my long-term goal.
Do they still have the Police Academy stunt show? Is that still a thing?
See, they got rid of that IP, unfortunately, which is crazy to me. But fun fact, if you're under the age of 30, you don't know what the fuck Police Academy is. So now it's...
If you're under the age of 30, do you know who Austin Powers is? What's the bloody...
That's a good point,
the lasting power of Austin Powers?
You know who Fat Bastard is, but you don't know who Austin Powers. So, no, it's now like a bogan stunt show is what it is. Like, and you're making a movie.
I mean,
like, and it's just some old fellas just doing doughies, which is, you know, pretty outstanding.
Yeah.
But do yourself a favor because it hasn't changed since 1987 either. So you'll bloody love it. Back to the Batman. Yes.
The trailer.
It's funny though, because there's a moment where I guess Paul Dano, who is the Riddler, I guess he gets arrested and he's sitting in front of a flat white, let's say. And when the camera pans over his shoulder and reveals it's a question mark in the coffee and you're like, he's done it. The Riddler, he's a super villain. He's super intelligent. He put a question mark in the coffee. He knew he was going to be arrested. I don't know, but yeah, I just got onto one evening by myself the logistics of going about how the Riddler would have organized for a question mark to be put into his coffee so that he can be arrested. And then he hasn't drank any of the coffee. Has he brought that coffee in separately? Has he asked the barista to put a question mark in the coffee?
You're assuming, though, that the POV is of people around it. Like, I think that this is like, it's only the audience is seeing the question mark.
Right.
And so I don't know that necessarily like he was timing it for when he was arrested. I think it was a coincidence, but I've seen the baristas do that art and it lasts for about what? At tops, 2 minutes, 2 minutes with a little bit of swishing. It's gone.
You've got two options as a barista artist without using a utensil. You've got like swan or dick.
Or Leaf.
It's Swan or Dick or Leaf.
Leaf.
It's Swan, Dick or Leaf.
Yeah.
You can't do a question mark unless you're getting in there and doing a little thing with a fork or a knife or something.
Can't do that in COVID, mate. You can't be sticking your finger in people's coffees to do a little.
I would have been more accepting of a cappuccino that has then been like, they've put like powder. With a little, and then a powder of a question mark over it. That's more easy and doable.
Yeah.
Like if you're trying to take this, like you franchise this out and have question mark coffees all over the world, they're not doing it with the crema. They're doing it with the chocolate powder.
I'll give you a fun little tidbit. So the guy who is the cinematographer who shot The Batman is an Australian guy called Greg Fraser, who was the DP.
From Kelsey Grammer, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Who is the
nice.
Is the DP who shot the sketches that Michael Chamberlain and Charlie Pickering and I would shoot in Melbourne 20 years ago. He was the guy. We were all working at the same production company. He was a director's assistant. He wanted to be... At that stage, you think he wanted to be a director, but then moved into being a cinematographer. So we have a bunch of shitty ass sketches, all shot by a guy who's probably going to win an Oscar one day.
Jesus. Wow. What a journey. That?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm really good at being associated with people who go on to be huge successes. That's my skill. I'm always just to the side. I'm just to the side. I'm the guy who gets my head photoshopped for Matthew Newton.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we are the same, you and I. Yeah. Well, I've heard that that's the person to be. You don't want to be the person with the yacht. You want to be the friend of the person with the yacht. Isn't that the thing?
You want to be Turtle? Like, is that the idea?
You want to be Turtle. You know, because you don't want to have to clean the boat. You don't want to have to, you know, pay the whatever. All right.
Do you think anyone who owns a yacht does their own cleaning? Like, if you can afford a yacht, do you think... Hey, sorry, kids. This weekend, we're going to go down and clean the super yacht. No.
That's very true, I guess, yes. But then you don't have to worry about paying for the cleaning of the yacht, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd take a yacht. But
yeah, you can have one.
That's what they say, is you want to be close to the people who are having the best life ever, not actually the person who's having, you know, all the success. But was he a good – could you feel the Batman energy when he was shooting your silly sketches?
No, like I thought he was – because he was a photographer and he shot stuff. He was just sort of starting out as a cinematographer. His photographs are amazing and he was always very good. But I didn't see him getting to the – Well, that's not true. I wouldn't limit to say that he's going to be shooting. I think he shot Dune as well, Dune and Batman or whatever.
But, are you serious?
Yeah, I think he shot Dune as well. He's done like huge, huge films. I think the film that, which was it? Was it, I want to say it was Animal Kingdom. It was one of those kind of successful Aussie art house films. That is, you know how there's that Melbourne look for a while, which is that desaturated blues and grays.
Mate, can't you see it on the Zoom screen right now?
Yeah, yeah.
Can't you look see very blue grade.
Yeah, you're very desaturated.
Yeah, no talk like this. Yeah, what are you doing in here?
Yeah, don't you love that Australian? What's the Australian film about? Well, it's about a secret. It's about a guy who comes back to a small town with a secret, and everyone just talks in hushed tones.
Ben Mendelsohn, in house doing thing.
Yeah, domestic. He's starting to sing, and a lot of pain. Look, and the soundtrack will just be a steel string guitar, just a kind of haunting couple of notes every now and then.
And at some point, we'll need to go out to the outback, and talk about the outback, the rolling, the plains, unforgiving.
Plain. When I'm pitching the film, Broden, it's almost like the landscape is a character itself.
Can you do an Australian film? Could you do an Australian film now that's about the barren, you know, the barren outback, and it not be a parody of itself?
Yeah, for sure, man. I reckon there's probably five or six in production. I think. Well, I think a lot of it also comes down to kind of funding. Like, you know, I found this myself when you're applying to funding bodies, like regional grants are a great way to get money. But if you're getting a regional grant, you have to shoot, you know, in a regional area. And it's also like you think about the budgets we have. Well, you're not going to write a sprawling, you know, story with like a million characters living in the city. It's hard to get permits to shoot in the city. It's easier to just find a small town and tell a small story. Like the only film I can think of that really sort of went for that kind of you know, urban sort of modern kind of feel was that Working Dog, Any Questions for Ben, you know, that film they did
with Josh Lawson,
where they try, it sort of felt like it was like a Richard Curtis film, or, you know, it was slick and shot in the city and stuff. And it's weird though, like Australians, the reality of the world we live in and the lives we have compared to the image we have of ourselves is so
different.
This idea that, you know, we all, like, it's, you know what it's like when you're in the States especially, like they all think that we sound like we're super blue collar, and it's like, no, I'm a private school softie. Don't worry about that, mate. I'm not tough at all.
No, absolutely. Yeah. You turn it on when you're overseas. Like, you just start, g'day, big fella, let me get one of them. But, well, that's interesting that he's gone on to do wonderful things. That's the director of Auntie Donna, Max Miller, his name is. He won at the start of 2 weeks ago, he won the best director for the Directors Guilds for, you know, shooting shooting comedy.
Outstanding achievement in the field of excellence.
With a camera, directing comedy with making ha-has with a camera.
Yeah.
He won that. And then I was looking at him yesterday as we recorded 16 podcasts in a row yesterday, eating pudding. You know, it took like 6 hours and it was absolute hell. And he shot it. Us, and I was looking at him going, 2 weeks ago, you were receiving an award for your craft, and now you're sitting there filming me, watching me eat my 14th pudding.
So that's rough.
We're dragging you down.
Did you eat the entire puddings or just bits of? Because that's five puddings each at least. Five and a half puddings each is a lot of pud.
No, I would do the columbaris, you know, the manu or whatever you do. You only have a little bit of it.
Right.
But here's the thing, like eating all day but not eating properly actually makes you more hungry. You know what I mean? You're never assuaged.
Satiated.
Yeah, satiated. So I was starving by the end of it, but I've been eating sugar for 8 hours. But we talked about this. We talked about this off the podcast.
Yeah.
It's the paywall. You got to keep the patrons happy, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Like this year we with Tofop made a concerted effort. Like we just have to put more bonus content up there. But then it's like we should have thought of that before we started a podcast network that has four podcasts with, like, you know, various different things required for that, because that takes up a lot of, and we have like other lives and, you know, careers and stuff going on as well. But that bonus content, there's the Weekly Planet, I'm a patron subscriber, there's a bunch of different podcasts or
Big Sandwich,
Comedy Troops, yes, that I am a supporter of, and it's fucking awesome. Like, and I do feel special. Like, I do feel like I have the inside track when you get to sort of see that video that is behind a paywall, it's like, yeah, we're friends now.
And it's incredibly appreciated. Like, people talk about how, you know, so many industries that were so well paying 20, 30 years ago are gone now. Mm. But what you do have now is, like, you can directly engage with the people that you do like and make sure they get the money.
Yeah. Well, I had a chat to James and Claire at Planet Broadcasting about Big Sandwich when they started it. And, you know, their rationale was quite solid. It's like, well, if something happens to Patreon, you know, we don't want to be fucked. We want to. And so I registered like a website and was getting all excited about it. And then I'm like, oh, this seems like a lot of work. I think I'll stick with Patreon. I'll pay them whatever their cut is and put up with it.
Exactly.
Because I don't know about you guys, but we have so many people complain about Patreon's functionality. Like, we have people who want to support who can't sign up, or, you know, the whatever the currency they've signed up in, it changes all kinds of shit. And, like, initially we tried to sort of do a tiered system, which is like, well, if you sign up for this, you get this. And then I'm like, you know what? Whatever you can donate, whatever you want to give to us, we'll appreciate it. You can have it all, mate. You can have it all. If you sign up at our very top level, we'll send you an autographed poster. But the rest of it is just carte blanche. Because it got too hard for me to manage. And
it's a pain in the ass.
What if someone signs up at a top tier and then they drop down? Do they still get access? Like, I just and Patreon, I would email them to say, how can I work out who's recently signed up and who's been a long term? And they're like, we don't know. I'm like, well, that doesn't fucking help me sort my reward tier. So in the end, it's just, it's open slather. If you want to be a Tofop subscriber.
We had a very similar thing where we had a fun idea that all of the pay levels would be 69 related. So you could join for 69 cents and then $6.90 and then $16.90 and then $69 and then $690 and then $69,000. And we're like, this is so funny. We're so funny and we're so cool. And then immediately put it up and I was like, and because it converts now, it's like in Australia, it's like
$1.12 or something.
$1.40, $7.20. Like,
that doesn't make any sense.
And then the comments next one are like, oh, 69's funny, isn't it? Ha ha. But it says $1.40. And we're like, we've got to fucking change this because it makes no sense whatsoever.
I wanted to read this little article to you. This is not a new article, but something that I thought you would maybe help me break down. I was just flicking through Instagram.
Yep.
And came across one of those. I don't know about you, but I'm just getting suggested content all the time. Like, I can't see anything my friends are doing anymore. It's always just fucking suggested content.
I got told off by my partner for my algorithm recently. Like, oh, yeah. So like I was on TikTok or something and the videos that were coming up were feminine leaning.
Yeah.
And I was being told off for my what my algorithm had developed to.
Yeah.
And that's the first time that's ever happened to me where I wasn't doing it, but my track record of the videos that I tended to stay on.
Yes.
I was being
I have 100% the same issue. I mean, mine suggests a man who is bisexual because it is buff dudes and buff chicks, like a lot of wrestlers and personal trainers and then like sexy chicks. But the thing is, like, I don't actually follow any. I follow a couple of personal trainers. I definitely don't follow any sexy chicks, maybe some celebrities, but not like girls who are specifically like in their bikinis. But yeah, man, I can't open that suggested window on my phone in front of my wife because it's like, this suggests that I spend all my time just like going through Instagram looking at nudie girls. But at this time I was sent a suggested post and it was a photo that you're probably familiar with. It's Keanu Reeves riding the subway. And it's just a photo of Keanu Reeves in New York looking like a regular dude riding the subway. And underneath it was this very heartfelt caption, which I started to read. And then as I read it, it struck me as being sort of increasingly more bizarre. So I want to read it to you. So now,
please
don't need to go over the tragedy of his childhood and, you know, he's had some tragedy in his personal life with his child and his partner and stuff. Let's pick it up from here. So with everything that's happened, Keanu Reeves never misses an opportunity to help people in need. When he was filming the movie The Lake House, he overheard the conversation of two costume assistants. One cried because he would lose his house if he did not pay $20,000. And on the same day, Keanu deposited the exact amount into the person's bank account. He also donated stratospheric sums to hospitals. In 2010, on his birthday, Keanu walked into a bakery and bought a brioche bun with a single candle and ate it in front of the bakery and offered coffee to people who stopped to talk to him. That sounds like... like if I told you there was a guy at the front of the bakery who's just like eating like a brioche bun with a candle and just like stopping people and offering them coffee, you'd be like, well, that sounds like he's a crazy person, right?
I mean, well, that's, you know, that's the laneway lifestyle of Melbourne. So I wouldn't bat an eyelid, to be honest. But that's just a stream of conscience from one like creative writing student, isn't it?
Yeah, it continues. After winning astronomical sums for the Matrix trilogy, I don't think he won them. He earned them.
it's Tats Lotto. No, it is Tats Lotto.
The actor donated more than $50 million to the staff who handled the costumes and special effects, the true heroes of the trilogy, as he called them. He also gave Harley Davidsons to each of the stunt doubles, a total expense of several million dollars. And for many successful films, he's even given up 90% of his salary to allow the production to hire other stars. Now, at this point, I'm like, this sounds like bullshit. So I went on Snopes and I did some searching around. He is known, he has given up portions of his salary. The Matrix thing about handing Harley Davidson's apparently is true. And he did take a pay cut in order to pay the stunt and visual effects team more. Nothing says he donated $50 million. Like, I think that once you get to a certain point of wealth,
yeah,
I imagine that, like, yeah, you could give a million, 2 million, 3 million. I still reckon... $50 million's a lot for a Keanu Reeves, don't you reckon?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. He wouldn't be getting paid $50 million for movies either, would he? Like, no one's paid that much.
I reckon he probably made close to $100 million from the Matrix films. If you think about, like, how successful the first one was, and the second one was, like, the highest rating R-rated film of all time for a while, and he would have had percentage points. So I reckon he could have come out. Well, I did some more digging, Broden. It turns out they estimate Keanu Reeves' wealth to be somewhere in the vicinity of $350 million.
Right.
So still, though, you're not giving up.
50's a lot of that, though, to just give away because you're feeling good.
Yeah. In 1997, some paparazzi found Keanu walking one morning in the company of a homeless man, listening to him and sharing his life for a few hours. Like, how do they know? How do they know that's what was going on?
And he gave him $50 million.
What if he was offering him his, like, I'll give you $5 million if I can just punch you in the face just one time. Like, I have more money. I've done lots of things in my life. I've never just punched someone in the face. Like, hey, homeless man, here's $50 million. Let me take out one of your teeth.
You tattoo Keanu across your head.
Most stars, when they make a charitable gesture, they declare it all to the media. He has never claimed to be doing charity. Well, I checked that on Snopes. He actually has a charity in his name, so he does. The last paragraph is the most heartwarming. Broden, this man could buy everything. Instead, every day he gets up and chooses the thing that cannot be bought, to be a good person. You also have a choice to be a good person, no matter your past. Be like Keanu.
Okay, yeah, right. That lovely little turn at the end there. It's beautiful.
Be more like Keanu.
Can you do this for like a general audition one day? Like when you're going monologue? In for like,
yeah.
Like George Miller or company. Something.
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves in 2004.
It is
and
amazing.
Do it as a dance piece.
I do love though that like, I mean, I love Keanu Reeves and I think he probably does do a lot of great work and he doesn't seem
he's a good actor.
It doesn't seem to be a celebrity douchebag in the right role. Is a good actor, I think.
Like, no, yeah, as soon as I said he's a good actor, I was like, oh, hang on.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, certain things challenge him a bit, but I agree. He's immensely appealing. He's so good looking. I mean, that's the crazy thing. My wife and I watched, Point Break or something recently. And it was like, how could you not put a camera on this guy? Like, he just, there are certain people, don't you reckon, that they're always going to be in front of a camera. Like, you couldn't be, you're not buying ice cream from Angelina Jolie. Or anything like that. Like you just
right.
You have to put a camera on that person.
There's a bunch of actors like who, you know, like yourself as well, who are so beautiful that they learned to be a great actor just by being like holding out.
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
Like
actors.
The early Brad Pitt versus the Brad Pitt, you know, being Jesse James.
Yeah,
that man just if you sit in front of a camera long enough and are hot enough, you'll become a great actor.
Working with like the best directors and the best scripts, you know, and you know Jack Nicholson's there giving you some tips. Like, yeah, I think you should improve at some point. But the Keanu thing I always find is fascinating is that we are so people, especially. They love this kind of mythology of him being this like normal guy. He rides a subway and stuff. And that's the other thing they say in the Snopes article. It's like, well, yes, like, you know, he lives in New York. A lot of people ride the subway, but there's also hundreds of photos of him riding limousines, you know, like arriving at the airport in a limousine. And he has like a vintage car collection and he has his own motorcycle brand and all that kind of stuff. But this idea that of just like wanting to deify this dude. Because we all know him, like you feel like you know them. And so it's like, well, he rides the subway. Did you see that video? He offered his seat to another woman. He is a good guy. We can believe in him. It's like, well, just ignore the rest of the world. Just ignore everyone that's actually in your life. And the idea that this person has posted this, not about like their uncle, you know, who does missionary work or whatever, but Keanu Reeves and is telling us to be more like Keanu. It's fascinating.
There's no way that Keanu or the people around Keanu don't spend some time looking at how he is consumed by the general public. There's just no way that, you know, it's completely natural. He may very well be the nicest guy in the world, but there is just no way that there's not some thought put into how he is perceived and that PR people around him would go, well, you are perceived as a Samaritan you know, the second coming at some point, like that is a daily discussion. There's no one who is that famous that it isn't discussed.
Well, I worked with an actor who is very popular and very successful and has absolutely no social media and has no interest in it. And that becomes a selling point in itself, because, you know, he sort of is positioned as like he's a man's man and he's a real guy, and it's legitimate with him in that case. He hasn't made a conscious decision. It's not like that sort of Sam Worthington thing of like, I'm going to wear Blundstones with my $6,000 suit on the red carpet. And when people ask me about why am I wearing scuff shoes, they go, oh, well, mate, you know, it's the only thing I had in the cupboard.
Got off the site.
Yeah, got off the site. It's like, mate, well, who tailored that Tom Ford tuxedo? That's like an $8,000 suit. But that was something that became part of the marketing and the appeal. It's like, well, you won't get a hold of him. Like, you're not going to, you know, if you want an interview, you're going to go through publicity because you're not going to actually speak to him in any other way. Like, he's not going to be putting his thoughts out. And I think when it comes across as genuine, that's when it works. Like, Keanu Reeves seems like a genuinely nice guy who, of course, has made $350 million. But occasionally riding the subway and stuff, it's like, oh, yeah, he hasn't lost touch. Like, Matt Damon, I reckon, has the same kind of aura. Like, when they were getting photos of him at Ballina Kmart and stuff like that, you're like,
yeah,
oh, yeah, you know. Like, I guess when they became big and it was Ben Affleck and J-Lo, and then Matt Damon just was like, oh, I'm just going to keep acting and, you know, hanging out with my mum as a school teacher and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You don't actually know these people, but you sort of get a sense.
I mean, like, you've probably had this too, where I have mates who are as famous as it gets in Australia, and if you walk around with them, there's no way, like I occasionally get stopped for eating 16 puds in a day on the street, someone who enjoys that. But like, for someone who's known legitimately as a household name,
yeah,
you can't walk around as a normal person. There's just no way. So like, even like, you would have to have two personalities. You'd have to really look after your personal self and then know that every time you walk out into the general public, you've got to do this other character. There's just no way.
Well, that's why I'm not famous, Broden, is I want to be able to just rub shoulders with the general population. I mean, I do actually, yeah, there has been times where I've been more recognizable than other times and I've been on shows that are popular or whatever. And I do actually forget. Like, I do forget that people will recognize you, and like, my self-awareness in public places, like, I've been at music festivals and shopping centers just doing dumb shit, forgetting that people have like mobile phones with cameras and stuff, yeah, like that. It's really like, I mean, if this had all happened 20 years earlier, if there'd been mobile phones in the late 90s, I'd be fucked. Like, in just in general, like, just socializing, like,
yeah, no, totally. Totally. But like, I was going to say, because, well, you mentioned Matt Damon, we're talking about points, and you know the Avatar story, yes?
What's that now?
Well, reportedly, James Cameron, for the first Avatar, came to Matt Damon and said something along the lines of, I'd like to offer you the role of the main guy in this movie over our mate Sam. But he's like, but I just want to let you know that, like, you don't need to do this movie for it. I'm very confident this is going to go well. However, if you do it, it will give you 10% profit share. So, and he said, no, I won't do it. And Sam, I don't think, got the same deal. But Matt Damon, like, essentially turned down.
What did it eventually gross? Like, it's almost close to $2 billion.
Highest ever, isn't it?
Yeah.
Highest ever at that point. So over $1 billion, I believe it was.
And so he would have had 10% of over $1 billion. Hang on. Let me put this in. Avatar box office. What? Take a guess. What do you think it made?
I reckon it made 1.2. You know, those glasses are higher. Expensive. 1.4.
Higher.
1.6.
Higher.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and this is in US dollars too.
Oh, 1.7.
Higher.
1.48.
No, lower.
Lower. Okay,
$2.847 billion.
So, like, he, you know, he probably would have had to go to.
He would
some
have made $284 million for one film,
and would have taken 6 months off. You know, he might not have been creatively fulfilled, but you know, it would have been all right.
Wow, can you fucking imagine that? I mean, he's fine. Matt Damon's fine. I think he's not, you know, stretched for cash or anything like that. But that would keep you up at night, I'm sure.
And I reckon Sam got union minimum.
That's crazy. That's, yeah. I had no idea it made that much money. And they've shot the sequels or something, or they're doing like five back to back. I'm not one of those Avatar haters. I quite enjoyed it when I saw it at the cinema. I thought it was fun, and I saw it in 3D, and it was the best use of that motion capture I'd seen to that point, that idea of, you know, making humans' faces look like alien faces. I don't know what the actual technical process is.
But I feel like they've been talking about two sequels coming out now for almost 78 years. I believe they were talking about the sequels coming out before moving pictures were captured.
Well, so, I think they're So is that the idea that they're shooting two back-to-back or something like that?
He's going full James Cameron on it. They're probably like, because this it came out 12 years ago now, maybe.
Is that right? God, I don't remember. All I remember is there was like a, okay, Avatar 2 is scheduled to come out at the end of next year. That's so fucking far away. That's crazy. And then Avatar 3 will be 2 years after that. That's insane. Okay. Do you think anyone, I mean, in the same way that do kids know who Austin Powers is, has too much time passed for Jake Sully? Well,
there was the moment when Avatar came out and everyone was like, Avatar. But that moment left very quickly. So, like, there's not a Avatar hype now. There might have been a few years after it, but the Avatar hype is gone.
And it wasn't like there was a heap of associated media. Like, I mean, I don't know, but I'm not a gamer, but it didn't sort of impact popular culture in the same way where there was like Avatar merch and Avatar games and Avatar figurines. I'm sure there are, but they'd be specialists. It's not like a Batman or Marvel or anything like that, right?
No, exactly. Oh, the thing that really I remember from Avatar is that the water looked really good.
Yes. What water?
There was some river water and it looked like real water. And I was like, wow, they've really cracked this sort of fake water.
I remember being freaked out by Sigourney Weaver's Avatar. Like there's a scene they're playing basketball or something and this big blue alien cat lady with Sigourney Weaver's face comes out and it has just enough similarity to Sigourney Weaver's face that you're like, ugh, it's that uncanny valley thing. She smiles. You're like, oh, Sigourney Weaver's smile. I mean, interested to see like how the technology has progressed. Did you see that Unreal Engine clip from the new Matrix game that went online yesterday?
No. What? Tell me about this.
So it was just some gameplay. I'm not a gamer, so you can correct me or pull me up on any of the things I'm about to say. So it's gameplay and some cinematic scenes generated by the Unreal Engine for the new Matrix game. And it looks like real life. Like I was watching it. I saw it on my phone. I had to blow it up. And once you blow it up, you can sort of say, oh, no, that's computer generated. But it looks incredible. Like the clarity, the sound design, because it's just someone walking around like a generic city, but it doesn't have that video game thing of like, you know, music's playing and stuff. It like sounds like a city. Like you can hear car horns and the jackhammer in the distance and the hubbub of people talking and stuff. And then the action itself is just like, looks like a Michael Bay movie. I couldn't believe it.
Is it so you are a character in the Matrix?
Yeah, you're some character in this new Matrix film.
Oh, that sounds sick.
Are you a gamer?
I play one game. Right. I play one game on loop, which is basketball.
All right, yeah.
I can't say. I mean, I actually struggle really, really hard with taking on a game and being bad at a game. Mm. But how about you don't play games at all?
I had a phase with the PlayStation 2 where I liked video games, but I'm not good at it. Like it's just one of those things where some people are musical and some people aren't. I'm just not good at video games. Like I have mates who buy video games and 3 days later they've finished it. And I'm like, it would be months. Like sometimes 6 months. I think I've only finished three games, Resident Evil 2. And I did that without a memory card. I just stayed up all night and just hoped I didn't die. I just played the whole thing through, but that took like months. And then one of the Grand Theft Autos, I think it was 4, I finished that. And then there was this one that Gatesy put me onto. It's called Jack. It's like a Ratchet and Clank kind of type thing where you're an alien with a little buddy who sits on your shoulder and you go around and...
Oh, I think I've heard of
it. It's like adventure action games, driving. You do driving missions and stuff like that. But that was 14 years ago, I think, the last time I played a video game.
I think I'm like you in that as soon as I get in a room that I don't know how to get out of, I just Like, they're like, I can't play anymore. That my brother made me play, you know, these Call of Duties where you get online and you just get destroyed by 10-year-olds. And if you want to see the face of your own mortality, like play a game with a 10-year-old and just see how, like, you are done. You are no longer needed. I was, when you play Call of Duty, you start off in a plane and you drop into this world and you've got to go around and kill the other teams. And sometimes you're put in charge of your teams. And I'd been playing this game for 10 minutes and I was put in charge of my team. And I had to pick a drop point to land. And people have their microphones on and there are people all around the place. And they started going, because my username is also Broden Kelly. It's not like Masterfucker 69 or anything. It's Broden Kelly. So they start going, Broden Kelly, where are we going? What are we doing? And I panicked and pulled my PlayStation, like I pulled the power out from the wall because I was like, I had an anxiety attack and didn't know what to do. So I just pulled it out and panicked.
Destroyed it with a hammer. I did the same thing. That's immensely stressful. I played one of those Call of Duties when I was visiting a friend in the States a couple of years ago. It was like a World War II one. And I can't walk and operate the aim at the same time. Like my gun's always pointed to the ground. And then when the shit kicks off, I'm like the guy's like, wah, just like firing into the air because I can't coordinate the two controllers. It's so difficult for me.
Yeah. But I feel like I'd be sick in a real war. Like I'd fucking dominate, kill, I reckon. Mate,
smash those fucking Nazis.
Yeah, that's my, you know, when I get killed in a video game, like, but if the war happens, I'll be ready.
Yeah. Well, I remember talking to a mate who was playing one of those online games. And he kept getting sniped by someone and started challenging this guy to a fight, like a real fight. Like, this is my address. I'm giving you my address. And he kept repeating his address. And he's like, come down here now in an hour. We're going to fight for real. Fight for real.
Yeah, man. I know this sounds like I'm being an old man because I am.
Yeah.
But the words that 12-year-olds use on the internet, if their parents knew what they were saying, holy shit. Like, it's the most unregulated world that no one over 30 knows about, you know, and should. It's horrifying. Yeah. Like, true. I never said this shit when I was 10.
Yeah. Is that would they be cancelled? Are you cancelling 10-year-olds? Is that what you're saying? We need to cancel all of them.
I want to, any kid who ever called me a nasty word, I want to come find and bash. And I don't care what age they are, but like, there's some nasty little boys out there. Tell you what.
Well, you heard it first. Broden Kelly is calling out all those nasty little boys. Broden, thanks so much for coming on FOFOP. I do really appreciate it. I'd love to get you back on at some stage. You can re-enter the TOEFOPiverse. Have you got anything that you need to plug or promote before you go?
Check out my philosophy. No, we're on tour next year. Fantastic. Maybe come to that. Just Auntie Donna. You'll see. We're coming to a town near you.
And the PUD vids?
Yeah, if you join our Patreon and listen to Three Men Fall Apart, that was really a horrible day.
Well, you can check all that at Patreon.com/AuntieDonna. Is that what it is? Or it's 69? AuntieDonna 69? Did you go that far?
Yeah. If you type in 69 into the internet, you should find it.
I'm Charlie Clawson.
And I'm Broden Kelly.